Alright, good morning. My name is Erin Park, and today I will be interviewing Mr. Hal McIntosh. Today is March 16th, 2015. And, alright, Hal, can you tell me a little bit about, like, your early life, where you grew up, if you had brothers and sisters, anything like that?
Well, I grew up in Detroit, Michigan, mm-hmm. and I had two older brothers. And an older sister. I was the baby of the family. And apparently my art interest started very early.
Nice.
My mother said that when I was five, I was doing caricatures of my little friends. And she could recognize who they were.
Oh, that's amazing.
I was 5 years old. And as the years went by, my early years, my parents didn't try to rush me into mm-hmm. art teachers or anything like that. They just saw that I had any materials that I needed, but they weren't trying to force me to study, you know, when I was young. Mm-hmm. They just let me alone because that's the only thing I wanted to do as a kid. And so I was fortunate in that respect. A lot of the parents that I've talked to in later years that have children that are mm-hmm. artistic, and they say, oh, what am I going to do? I've got to send them somewhere to study. Mm-hmm. I said, well, you know, don't rush them into, don't overdo your pushing them, because that'll turn them right off. Just do what you can, cooperate, but don't make a big deal mm-hmm. out of it. And if they're really going to do something in their lifetime, whatever occupation mm-hmm. they might end up, sometimes those interests start when kids are very young. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you might have a graduate degree in engineering, and you end up doing something totally different.
Yeah.
I was fortunate enough to know all my life what I wanted to do.
That's amazing. And it's nice that your family was so supportive. That's great.
Well, they were supportive by not...
By not pushing you. Pushing. Yeah.
These hysterical mothers that I've seen in the past, mm-hmm. you know, coming to me for advice because their child is doing some drawings, and what'll I do?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, leave him alone.
Yeah. So you've been able to make your living as an artist essentially your whole life, and that's extremely amazing and very significant. How has that been for you?
Well, it's a very difficult mm-hmm. situation when you're an artist. There's not a lot of jobs sitting around waiting for you.
Yeah.
I was very fortunate in the years I was at Rollins as a temporary student mm-hmm. years ago, of course, and the brother of one of the Rollins students was an artist, and I met him. He lived in Silver Springs.
Mm-hmm.
And I was at that point later on had a master's degree from the University of Michigan, teaching there.
Mm-hmm.
And what do? You know, you don't walk out with those credentials mm-hmm. and walk into a job. Nobody's waiting for you. And this friend had some really nice portraits that he had stacked on the floor against mm-hmm. the wall. He was a landscape painter. And I said, I didn't know you did portraits. And he said, well, I studied with Jerry Farnsworth on Cape Cod. He's quite a prominent mm-hmm. American portrait painter. And he said, why don't you write Jerry Farnsworth and see if you can get a job as his assistant
mm-hmm.
and learn how to do really commercial portraits. And that way you might be able to make a living to start out with. And I did so, and mm-hmm. Was accepted with my credentials.
Yeah.
I didn't even have a car at that time. I got off the bus and North Truro, Massachusetts, and was directed how to walk to the professor's house, and Jerry Farnsworth and Helen Sawyer were married, and she was a well-known artist and taught in the school, and this was basically a school portraiture school, minor landscape work that she taught, and he taught the portrait work. And I was with him for 5 years. He had another school in Sarasota.
Okay.
And Siesta Key, rather. Mm-hmm. And I was down there during the winter.
Mm-hmm.
I worked in a hotel. I was busboy, waiter, several other jobs, hotel on the beach, and went to school and taught with him in mornings. And that exposure through 5 years with him really got me so that I was able to make some money doing portraits. And I had this hotel I was working in part-time after the morning school sessions. Someone saw my work there and recommended me, unknown to myself, to the board of directors of an art museum in Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
And later on I was accepted and became director of the museum there for 5 years. But those accidental things that happen, you know, you meet someone who's done portraits, and for 3 years I did portraits in Provincetown, Massachusetts, on the street, let's say. I had a studio in a building that was right on the commercial street there, but at night I had a display outside, and people would book portraits for their children and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Pastel portraits done for $10 in a mat and in a bag in 45 minutes.
That's so quick.
Major. It was a shock to get to have to start that kind of a routine.
Yeah.
I got used to it, and I did 6 to 8 portraits a day for the whole summer, because I had summers off from teaching, and that led all those portraits. I did hundreds of them, literally, in 3 years, every 8 days a week, 7 days a week. So I have a record of lots of portraits in my career. Now those $10 portraits would be $60 portraits.
Yeah, exactly.
It was back those times. But believe it or not, I bought my beach house on Cape Cod with the money from just from those $10 portraits.
Wow.
And that I was saving all that money in cash in the safe deposit box to go to Japan.
Yeah.
And this house came up for sale on Cape Cod on the beach, and I opted to buy this house with that money, and I got to Japan later on in the years.
And,
I had a wonderful experience in Japan, which is another story.
So I know that you have a true love for Cape Cod. What drew you here to Winter Park?
That's the story that starts in Sanford. My sister and her husband were stationed. He was stationed in Sanford at the Navy base there at that time.
Okay.
And I came down for part of my high school and lived with them in Sanford. They had an old house on the lake right opposite the airport, so the planes were taken off over the house. And they decided, after he left the Navy, to stay in Florida because their son was, young son, was doing better health-wise in Florida for some reason, I don't know what. But they decided to stay here.
Yeah.
And they had a house in, rented a house right on the highway and across from Lily Lake.
Okay.
In Winter Park.
Mm-hmm.
Anyhow, families tend to follow families.
Yes, they do. And
eventually, my parents moved down to Florida because my sister and her husband were settled there. And later on, my brother, older brother, moved to Florida. My other brother moved to Florida.
So it was just a gradual process.
So that's a story that people in Florida that are Yankees, basically, Washa Shores, they used to call us, on Cape Cod, they follow one another, you know, and it's just happened in different time periods.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd go back and forth when I was in college to my parents' house. And so we all ended up here. And I stayed at it, and Winter Park has been very good to me. Mm-hmm. I had wonderful exposure on Park Avenue for many, many years, which a lot of artists didn't have that good luck, but the wonderful old Golden Cricket shop had a gallery right in front of the shop that was all mine.
Oh, wow.
For years.
Mm-hmm.
So I had like 10 paintings in the gallery and a painting in the window, but it was a gift shop.
Okay.
But I had that exposure to the sidewalk with one major painting.
Mm-hmm.
And people would come in and buy or see painting there for a number of years. And right after that, I was with the Center Street Gallery, who actually, I think they owned the property that the Cricket was, the Cricket was in. And, Hugh McCain and Jeanette Genius were friends, and even Mr. McCain was one of my part-time professors at Rollins.
Oh, nice.
How will they ever let me in Rollins? I don't know, but I was only doing art work there. But then I had exposure at the Center Street Gallery, which was actually ended up right next door to the Golden Cricket.
Okay.
And almost one situation between the two of them. And after long years at Center Street Gallery and a number of shows there, I went with Solarte, which was a shop down the avenue owned by a French gentleman and his family, and had a big show there and had my work on display there for several years, which was another exposure on Park Avenue. And I've lucked into things like that, but
Miller Gallery.
Miller Gallery, I was with them, but they weren't getting the kind of support from the community.
Mm-hmm.
Winter Park was, and maybe still is, a little difficult for a gallery.
Yeah.
Really, I don't know why, because Winter Park people have plenty of money, but Miller Gallery stayed only for a year or so.
Okay.
They just weren't. It just making wasn't the making sales
it. Yeah.
And they left, so I don't consider, you know, that a long association with them.
Mm-hmm.
But
Naples.
Well, Naples. I had careers in this. I don't know whether this leads directly into Naples, but friends of mine on Cape Cod had a gallery where my work was exhibited, and they were both professors in Boston.
Okay.
At universities there and stuff. And they did the gallery work in the summertime and had a beautiful gallery, one of the prettiest ones on that end of Cape Cod. And after a few years of success in that gallery, I had several shows there, they decided to give up the teaching, made a decision, and the gallery was doing so well, they decided to have a second gallery in Florida. And I met them in Florida, and they were in Sarasota at that time, and they were looking there. And they, they're both close friends of mine, as well as handling my work. And they kept, when we were in Sarasota, they kept talking about Naples. And I said, we're sitting in Sarasota, and you're talking about Naples. Let's go to Naples.
It's not far from there.
And they wanted my advice and stuff. And so we all went to Naples, and they ended up renting a space in the nicest part of Naples downtown. And it was only a couple of years. They were so successful. Basically, the only really good gallery at Naples at that time. Now there are probably 100 galleries in Naples. But as the years went, 2 years by, they built a gallery on 5th Street South, I think it was. The Naples Art Gallery. Elegant, gorgeous gallery.
Nice.
Big gallery. And shows with really top artists. And it was probably one of the prettiest galleries in the country.
Wow.
From outside and from inside. They had mostly paintings, but they also, part of the gallery was elegant gifts and antique, oriental antiques, in a, just a side gallery. But they were there for years.
Yeah.
And most successful.
That's nice.
And I had 24 one-man shows there.
Just there? How many have you had in total again?
35.
That's awesome.
But these shows were something else.
Yeah.
They actually, your one-man show only ran for a week.
Okay.
Which is unusual.
Mm-hmm.
People were allowed to watch them hang the show on Saturday, and they did. People did come. They wanted to see what was coming up, and whether they wanted to go to the opening on Sunday. And but they weren't allowed to buy anything, which is unusual.
Yeah,
they wouldn't let somebody buy something that was supposed to go in the show. It would not be in the show.
So. Okay.
So Sunday night, are we getting close to the end here? You're looking at your list.
I'm trying to, I'm just making sure that it's picking everything up. Okay. Sorry.
Well, so the openings were Sunday night, and this is a, this is a riot. Naples is very elegant. I had special clothes to wear when I had my openings because, you know, you don't wear pink sport coats in, in Winter Park. Naples is very formal, but very resorty and very rich.
Bizarre.
What? he can't stop talking. Anyhow, on Sunday night, people at 6 o'clock would line up to come in to the gallery. The doors would not open till 6. And here we go again. As they came in, sometimes in formal clothes, because they were going out somewhere. As they came in, they were not allowed to buy a painting. They could look for a half an hour. And at the end of half an hour, they could make a bid on the painting.
Okay.
So the wife, they would come in and they'd quickly
Find one that they loved.
They had seen them on Saturday. Mm-hmm. So they already knew there was one they loved. So the wife would park her husband in front of the painting. And he was standing in front of the painting with his arms folded, blocking the painting.
Oh, my goodness.
So the other Naples folks knew that.
That was taken.
So at 6:35, they were allowed to say, the wife would say, "We have that one." But they didn't want people to pre-sell from seeing the work the day before, whatever, a week before. And they wanted everybody that was coming to the show, basically, to be able to buy a painting.
Mm-hmm.
And so, consequently, the sales were almost always right the first couple of days, including the opening night. And the rest of the week, some of them would be out in their yachts and stuff, so they didn't want to miss these shows if they looked important. And so I basically made my living in 1 week out of the year.
That's amazing. That's
a Naples show.
Yeah.
And if it rained at the opening night, that put a damper on sales.
Mm-hmm.
But it worked out 24 times, so.
That's great.
And the gallery truly, you'll see the picture.
Yeah.
It was probably one of the prettiest galleries in the country. Very, very beautiful. Mm-hmm. These guys had good taste. And they handled Cerulli's glass. A lot of well-known painters from California and other parts of the country.
Mm-hmm.
And I've always been interested in antiques. I bought antiques in Winter Park for them to put in their gallery, in their sales gallery, antique area there. And they didn't have time to scout antiques, and I love scouting antiques.
That's nice.
So I would buy stuff for them, and they would sell it at the gallery for 10 times for what I got.
Yeah.
I was getting good bargains from dealers here in Winter Park and elsewhere.
Don't forget the Blue Heron Gallery and the Cove Gallery.
Those good galleries on Cape Cod. I'm not going to forget them, but I exhibited at the Blue Heron Gallery, another top gallery in Cape Cod, for many years. And before that, the Cove Gallery. So I had those two galleries on the Cape.
So you've been all over.
Well, you got to, when you're painting every day, you need the exposure. And I ended up being on Cape Cod for today. It's 6 months of the year on Cape Cod. When I was teaching, I had shorter summers. But now it's half here and half on Cape Cod.
Yeah.
Cape Cod, fabulous place for artists. The light is gorgeous there for painters. In the portrait studio there, on a gray day, the light was absolutely gorgeous on the models on a gray day. very cool light. Florida has a hot light.
Yes, it does.
It's not just the heat. It's a harsher light for a painter than Cape Cod. That's why Cape Cod has many, many artists.
Okay, that's interesting.
The most famous American painter today, Eric.
Yes, Edward Hopper.
Yeah.
Motherwell.
Well, not, not Marlboro, probably the most famous American painter of all time,
mm-hmm.
is Robert Eric.
Who?
Who's the person you used?
Oh, Edward Hopper.
I'm talking and I'm forgetting as fast as I can.
The Edward Hopper's house from Hal's house.
Oh, wow. Yeah. That's awesome.
And I knew Edward Hopper through this Farnsworth, who had the school.
Mm-hmm.
I went to a lot of cocktail parties with him. And one time, Jerry Farnsworth said that we're going to this party and Edward Hopper will be there. But and I'll introduce you, but don't expect him to say much because he isn't a big talker. And I did meet him that night, and he was a very polite listener and wonderful, very imposing, tall, down. But I could see their house from down the beach on the cliff from my house. And anyhow, I was not a close friend of Edward Hopper's, but we were close enough. We sat in the Christian Union Church when they had these flea market sales of clothes and china mm-hmm. and stuff. And his wife and Mrs. Farnsworth were trying on cheap clothing. Blouses and suits and coats and stuff. No. We would.
Mrs. Farnsworth was Helen Sawyer.
I've already made that clear.
Oh, okay. Represented at the Morse Museum of American Art.
Okay. Helen Sawyer is Mrs. Farnsworth.
Okay.
And recognized in major museums mm-hmm. as well as Farnsworth was. But both of those couples, Farnsworth and Hopper, were both active during the Depression.
Mm-hmm.
And they were frugal.
Yeah.
Farnsworth had a garden and they grew their own vegetables. They didn't go to grocery stores except to buy meat.
Mm-hmm.
But they grew everything else and they were used during the Depression. Jerry Farnsworth, a famous portrait painter, would make clothes out of old bags, flour bags, that they used to have patterns on the big bags of flour for his wife.
Mm-hmm.
And very frugal.
Yeah.
And that's why those two wives were trying on cheap clothes.
Because that's what they always knew. Sale.
Well, they just, you know, they weren't shoppers. And Eric and I was, Edward and I sat there and he would just shake his head every time they came out in one of these outfits, and, you know, outfits for $2. At that time he was a well-known painter.
Yeah.
Extremely well-known. Now he's considered one of the top American painters,
mm-hmm.
period.
Yeah.
But a wonderful, wonderful man.
Yeah.
His wife did all the talking.
Always.
I find out from the wife, he's so quiet because
he has a wife to make up for it.
she talked all the time. That's probably why Edward was fairly silent, but a big, tall man, very mm-hmm. imposing man. And his work is fabulous.
Yeah,
absolutely.
It's beautiful. Can you tell me a little bit about your teaching philosophy? I know teaching was a big part of your life.
Oh, absolutely. I've taught for over 40 years. And I think my philosophy is basically in teaching is how to teach the students how to see.
Mm-hmm.
And people don't see like artists. And it takes a long time to get them to that point. But I also wanted them to end up being taught, being brought out as an individual painter, not as one that
tried. It's a cookie cutter.
Well,
standard.
Not the cookie cutter, but so many students, and many of my early students, wanted to study with me because they wanted to paint like me. And I went to two schools with Farnsworth and later on Bassford School, where they taught only their style. And the students were painting as much as they could like the teacher.
Mm-hmm.
My philosophy was that I would expose my students to different techniques. Every couple of weeks, they would have a new project. This week we're going to do an abstract, or next week we're going to do this. It shocked them because they, you know, they had to start thinking differently because these were specific instructions that were going to go in this direction, art-wise. And I would find, after a long time, I had students for years, some of them, by being exposed to different techniques and presentations of art, I would find one person suddenly would just glow when
they found what they were supposed to do.
What they loved. And I would say, okay, Mrs. So-and-so or Mr. So-and-so, you're going to stay with this technique as long as you can, forever if possible.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to keep trying stuff. And as I kept students for a long time, they loved my classes. And in spite of the fact they were in shock when I had to expose them to different techniques, but eventually they all ended up with their own style. And that's the biggest service you can do to a student, is find them, find what's in them.
Yeah.
Teach them how to see.
Mm-hmm.
I had students would come to me practically in tears after a couple of years studying, and they'd say, I finally know what you meant when you said, you're going to learn to see. I'm seeing things so much differently. I'm visual.
Yeah.
All my life, I've been visual. I could turn my head and see subject matter around me anywhere, or in the gutter. You know, I'd tell them, I'd say, look down, you know, look at the cement. There might be something there that's beautiful. Look at that garbage can. You know, there's beauty everywhere.
That's a remarkable skill to have.
Well, but I had severe exposure in the portrait school to a particular style that I was learning because he taught only his style. After that, in time, you go to your own style.
But
there's a long delay if you have been with one teacher a long time. You're only doing his style of work. And a lot of artists do the same basic look the whole lifetime. People don't recognize my work sometimes because one day I'll do an abstract and the next day I'll do a floral. And, you know, I love changing from one to another. I don't consider abstracts any different than realistic paintings. Every painting starts out as an abstraction. And a painting is a painting. And the art world has expanded so much now that it's gone way beyond painting. It's in constructions and light shows and huge presentations of sculpture against other things. You know, it's very complex now. But as far as the painting world goes, I just get energy from doing different things.
Yeah.
It energizes me. And I have ideas now, you know, that I can never get to, I'm sure. But I'm still clipping things out of magazines that I like, and just keeping stuff that,
yeah,
you know, paintings that I'm exposed to through the literature I get, that I admire.
Mm-hmm.
You should talk to some of my old students. They're getting old like I am, you know, and they're having big shows.
Yeah.
A lot of my students went right on to professional work and were making prices sometimes higher than mine. But they all had their own look eventually. That's why I kept students so long,
mm-hmm,
because they just wanted that assurance, and they still got exposed to a lot of unusual approaches, but the core of about 30 students stayed with me for years.
Wow.
And I've done portraits of a number of my students,
mm-hmm,
in the past. I had a commission to do a portrait of a really lovely lady from Tiberias area up there, and she had me over to talk about a portrait, and she said, I realized right away that there was something, she had a problem. She'd had a stroke, and she didn't like the photographs that were being taken of her to present to friends and family and all the stuff. She was getting on, and she's very concerned about facial problems. And she was still a beautiful lady, but mm-hmm, you could tell she couldn't sit for a portrait for a long period of time. But I took some photographs of her. We had lunch a couple of times and talked. And I did a large, major portrait of her that nobody would recognize. That there was a distortion in her face. She loved it.
Aww.
And her family loved it. She wanted to leave a heritage.
Of course.
And it was a challenge for her because she didn't want to be photographed, and she had dedicated caretakers and stuff that wanted a picture of her and stuff. But ended up doing quite a nice portrait.
Yeah.
But I knew her for so many years,
mm-hmm,
and I knew how to eliminate those problems in the work. But you don't often get challenges like that.
Mm-hmm.
It was a major challenge for me. But and every portrait is a major challenge because you really want to get the essence of the person as well as the outward visual quality of them, and mm-hmm, have to get something a little deeper than
that. Yeah. Is that what you kind of want people to get when they look at your art, that there is something? Like, what do you want people to take away from your art, would you say?
Oh, whatever they want. I've been pleased to have letters from people that hated abstract art. And they see some of my abstracts, and they thank me for, now this is possibly through my nephew, and his dental office has a number of my paintings,
mm-hmm,
and abstracts and realistic, mm-hmm, both, and they spend time there, and they see abstract work, and they finally say, well, I guess that's all right stuff. But a lot of people just close their minds to abstract and other radical approaches to art. And it's all the same. It's, you know, I minored in sculpture. I would just be happy as ever to go back to sculpture, mm-hmm, and do nothing else, but it's a little hard to combine the two careers because sculpture is messy.
Yeah.
It's messier than painting. And my sculpture from Michigan, minor in sculpture at the University of Michigan. And my work there, the pieces went into a gallery out of town, mm-hmm. and the gallery owner skipped the country, mm-hmm. sold the work, kept all the money, and never paid his artists. So I never got my sculpture back, and I never got any money from him. But that was a wild chase there. But, I've done murals. Did a mural at the University of Michigan that was about 60 feet long.
Wow.
And I've done major murals, did a major mural in a restaurant. And, you know, mm-hmm. shoe store, or children's shoe store. I did some window display back, you know, piddling to a lot of minor career stuff like that. But it's all tied up with art, mm-hmm. you know.
What do you think inspires you to create?
What inspired me?
Mm-hmm. It sounds like a lot of different things.
Well, my vision, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
I'm inspired by a lot of artists,
mm-hmm.
each for a different reason.
Yeah.
I can't minimize that. But I just see stuff and it excites me. I say, it'd be wonderful to paint that.
Mm-hmm.
I still have that. I'm not able to paint 8 hours a day and never did.
Mm-hmm.
I paint mostly in the afternoons most of my life. Do the laundry in the morning. But in my teaching career, I had to teach and paint also. So when my students were finished for the week, I got my studio back because
mm-hmm.
we both had the same studio. But I get excited sitting where we are here, seeing birds and animals and trees and flowers and all that stuff. I just see things, and I'm fortunate if I have photographs of things that
mm-hmm.
I can't see again. I painted outside for years. As I got on later in my career, I did everything in the studio and worked from reference material,
mm-hmm.
Tons of reference material. Like an illustrator
mm-hmm.
has tons of mm-hmm. material to work from. But my paintings got large, and if you're painting outside in the wind, the painting is flopping in the wind. And I find that painting outside quite often, when you get the painting inside, you see that the colors are difficult.
Mm-hmm.
Being out in the hot sun,
transferring
that to, it's not as good when you get it inside
mm-hmm.
as it was. But I think you have to paint from life outside, and from portraits you have to paint from life to learn how to paint without the sitter or without being in front of the subject.
Mm-hmm.
Because your inventiveness comes out when you're isolated in your studio.
Yeah.
You may have started something out. I'm working on an abstract now, and just as a joke, when it gets in the show, I'm going to call it Two Horses. And it's an abstract painting. But if you'll look before you leave, there are two Chinese wooden horses in my apartment here.
Mm-hmm.
I was painting them on Cape Cod in this painting, both those horses. And I just got that I wasn't getting it the way I wanted to. So I started scribbling them out with other colors. And underneath this abstraction is a painting of those two horses. But when it doesn't work, you know it, and you say, well, I'm going to go on. And to paint the canvas white to get rid of the two horses is a shame, because there's color there, mm-hmm. and there's shapes there. And do your new painting into that, leaving some of the... You can't recognize anything about yeah. the horses, but that's where the painting started out. Yeah. If it were ever x-rayed, my voice is so weak from my breathing problems, but I'm sure it comes out in your
Oh,
machine.
Yeah, it'll show up.
But if they ever x-ray that painting,
then you
see
would see
the horses underneath there. And but the other abstractions just paint themselves.
Mm-hmm.
But once you get something down on a canvas, I don't care what it is, just a splash of blue out of the blue. The rest of the work, you're painting into that piece. It's a piece of a puzzle.
Mm-hmm.
It may have nothing to do with final painting. But, you know, it's a lot more in a painting than people know.
Yeah.
Because they don't see the progression of it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I want to mention these TV shows with artists, because most artists don't consider those people artists. I also cancel that. anyhow, it's a wonderful career.
Good.
And you saw some of my acting photographs there.
That was wonderful.
done a little bit of that, but...
Winter Park Art Festival also.
Yeah, the Winter Park Art Festival, you were kind of a founding member of that. That's a big deal.
Yes, and I lived just down the street from the festival. I lived across from the Langford Hotel, which mm-hmm. is gone now. And then eventually that was my Japanese house, which was quite a notable thing in Winter Park, because there weren't any Japanese houses here. And I had been to Japan and had a house fire and remodeled the whole place in Japanese style
mm-hmm.
after my visit to Japan. And anyhow, during the art festival years, I was walking all my materials down to Park Avenue and setting up in front of my Golden Cricket mm-hmm. gallery. And after a few years, I realized that I'm on the street trying to sell paintings, and my studio is, or my gallery is right behind me. And they make a commission on the sale of paintings, so that's why I only did the art festival for,
mm-hmm.
I don't know, four or five years. Because I had gallery connections
mm-hmm.
on the avenue, and you don't do that.
Your
gallery back then was taking 33 1/3%.
Mm-hmm.
Nowadays, it's 50%. And in New York, some galleries taking 70%.
Wow.
So the people don't realize that artists that work in galleries are paying quite a commission
yeah.
to galleries, especially if you get the kind of exposure that New York
mm-hmm.
major galleries give you. But I opted out of the art festival because, you know, it just was, I was competing with
yeah.
myself. But it was fun back in those years, you
mm-hmm.
know, it was pretty much local. And it grew and grew and grew and grew. And now the artists go, they paint or sculpt or do their craft part of the year, and the rest of the year they travel with Joe, street shows, and they have their tents and all that stuff, and that's half of their exposure.
Yeah. It's
possibly happened because they don't have to pay the galleries, you know. But that's not the only reason. It's good exposure. But it's a wonderful learning experience to, to have your work shown anywhere. You get comments, you get criticisms, and you get to see your own work. My paintings generally don't hang around. I think I told you this before.
Yeah.
When I finish a painting, and through the years, having gallery associations, when I think the painting's finished, I frame it and get it to the gallery. And I forget them because I'm thinking of the one I'm working on.
The next stuff, the upcoming one.
And I've only hung one painting of my own.
Yeah, that's what you had told me before.
In my apartment, and there was my house in Winter Park. It's a very large abstract painting. And you won't believe this, but I don't never hung my own paintings.
What's the reason behind that? Do you have a reason?
I wanted to go to the gallery and sell. And I'm interested in the new one. I don't want to... If I kept that painting sitting around, I'd see something.
You keep moving forward.
I'd change it or this or what. But I just got rid of it so I could get on with the next one. And I've produced a lot of work over the years. But that particular painting sold to my friend's mother, hangs in the Mayflower.
Wow.
She's got it in her apartment. It'll be in the show.
Okay.
And I just ran across a letter from Maury Hurt, who I told you is probably the best artist in Winter Park in Orlando. It was a very nice, sensitive letter from him from a show that I had. And that painting he mentioned specifically. I think I'll have that framed and put it next to the painting in the show because people know who Maury Hurt is here, and his word
is important.
Compliment. It was an extreme compliment. But the way he worded it, it's like an artist could word something, not like just a casual visitor. It's a very sensitive approach that he put in this letter to me. So you'll see that letter. It's here. You can read it if you want. But I would be happy to keep painting for the next 20 years. I remember seeing pictures of artists, not Dufy, but I'm losing it now for a minute, but he was bedridden anyhow. Think of his name, and I made 8-foot brushes for him,
so he could reach.
And he could reach the canvas. That's how some artists are. I could paint hundreds more pictures, but they're gonna wheel me around pretty soon. It's been interesting talking to you, and I hope some of the stuff you understand.
Oh, this is wonderful. I'm
sort of different than other teachers.
It's been great talking to you. I feel like I've learned a lot.
Good. Well, see, you can paint now.
I can.
Yep. Anybody can paint.
Can I ask you one last question?
Sure.
I know that you worked at the Palaszczuk Museum. Did you know Albin and his wife, Emily? And
yes.
How was that for you? How were they?
Albin, I didn't know that well. Saw him just on 2 or 3 occasions and talked. But Emily, I knew and sat with her She made cookies for me. cookies that are typical of her home country, very complex little cookies. And she even gave me the equipment to make them myself.
Wow.
But knowing Alvin and being a sculptor myself part-time, and also my my brother-in-law, Ken Wacker, along with Weber Haynes, a lawyer, were very influential in the early Pulaski years mm-hmm. in keeping the estate and running the whole estate.
The institution,
and,
yeah.
And working on its future mm-hmm. Through Alvin when he was alive, and then very, very kindly through Emily because she was left, but they were extremely influential in the early years. And I was artistic consultant for the museum for 5 years.
Wow.
And I actually climbed up on a huge painting of a man carving his own destiny. And I was cleaning that and doing that. I also knew so much about what Alvin would have liked.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a very sensitive thing because you're put with responsibility when an artist is gone. And he specifically had feelings, different feelings about his work that I could see.
Mm-hmm.
And I restored things that I discovered that he had done.
Yeah.
And I realized how religious a man he was,
mm-hmm.
totally dedicated to his religion. And my partner and I designed the wall in front of the museum and the gates that go mm-hmm. in. And Eric Barty did the chapel over the ceiling of the chapel, and mm-hmm. I had the paintings of the Stations of the Cross framed and redone because they were actually rotting out in
yeah.
that damp studio. And I did painted patina on all of the Stations of the Cross were done in plaster
mm-hmm.
and they were white. And I first saw them stacked somewhere, and I convinced my brother-in-law mm-hmm. that they should be put on a wall. And they built this wall, and we installed these plasters on the wall, life-size from the originals. And I painted them and painted a patina, which is done to age the...
Mm-hmm.
to fake the age of a bronze piece.
Mm-hmm.
And I did that, all those statues.
That's amazing.
Those stations. And they were later reproduced by another artist for a client. And they came down, and now they're having some of them cast.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them are still plaster, but... just a portrait of Alvin that hangs in the museum was done by Charles Hawthorne.
Mm-hmm.
A beautiful portrait was over the mantle. I don't know where it is now. But Charles Hawthorne was a Cape Cod painter.
Mm-hmm.
And my teacher, Jerry Farnsworth, and his wife, Helen Sawyer, both famous painters, studied with Hawthorne.
Mm-hmm.
So, a coincidence.
I was going to say, that's a huge coincidence.
I didn't know Hawthorne, but Hawthorne's a fabulous
mm-hmm.
Painter of figure. Cape Cod has museum has wonderful work of his in mm-hmm. Provincetown. But he taught in Provincetown in the open air. They had models out by the beach. And mm-hmm. There are old photographs of my teachers at their easel mm-hmm. with him teaching with the Provincetown Harbor yeah. in the background.
And you just so happened to paint Alvin, too.
Well, I don't know how they commissioned, how they found this fabulous painter to do Alvin, but Alvin must have known his work. Mm-hmm. Because that is a great portrait. Mm-hmm. But it's a small world, you know. But
that's crazy.
And late in the years that I, you know, way back when I knew Alvin briefly, I met another sculptor, a major sculptor, Mahanra Young, the grandson of Brigham Young. I was in his studio, and I forgot where it was, but I was invited somehow to get into his studio.
Yeah.
And there was this huge portrait of a seated gentleman that was like about 25 feet tall in his studio in clay mm-hmm. that was going to be cast. And as a young student and learner, I was so impressed seeing the scale of that work. He said, this is going to be cast. And he said, I'm sorry you weren't here when I was working on the 180 foot tall piece took a whole train
wow.
to take this sculpture mm-hmm. to where the Mormons where are all the Mormons?
In Utah. Yeah.
And it's a gigantic statue with dozens of figures on it. I have no idea the height of it, but it's a major mm-hmm. piece. And to see stuff in the studio that's going to go to the foundry, you know, eventually, and just, I've been very lucky to have those visits. Mm-hmm. And I had private visits with one of the top American architects, Philip Johnson, the famous glass house in Connecticut, mm-hmm. Was a famous American accomplishment mm-hmm. He's passed away now, but I had a private visit with him with another architect friend of mine to see this glass house in person mm-hmm. and to meet him. And I've just been very lucky to have exposure to some very yeah. great people. And anyone who knows architecture knows, you know, Philip Johnson's right up there with the top architects in the world. But this house was fabulous. It's in the woods, basically, and it has no light fixtures mm-hmm. in the house at all. All the walls are glass all the way around. And the house is lighted by lights outside in the trees that you can't see. Mm-hmm. And on a rheostat, those lights can be turned on so you can read in the house. And you never see a lamp or anything.
That's amazing.
It's an amazing house. Yeah. You'll see it in the book.
And there's also your involvement with Maitland Art Center and Andre Smith.
Well, I can't talk forever.
That's a story.
She's going to run out of juice.
I was going to say, I can come back another day. We can talk about a lot more stuff, too.
Well, there's quite a good story for you on my association with Andre Smith.
Yeah.
And the Maitland Arts.
It's kind of where you got your, like, kind of your main start here, right? In Florida? Is that where you kind of began?
I began.
Many years before,
my association with Andre Smith is worth another little time
okay.
on your thing. You've got plenty of time.
Got a lot of stuff.
To do that, but I was very close to Andrew Smith, and I happened to be the only living Bach fellow.
Mm-hmm.
I was invited to live there and have my own studio there 3 different years,
wow.
different times,
mm-hmm.
before I went in the service and after I came out of the service. And I was very close to Andre Smith. It was called the Research Studio mm-hmm. then. And the artists that were invited there, all financed by Mary Curtis Bach from mm-hmm. Bach Tower
yeah.
in Florida. They were all older artists. And I was the only, I was 18.
You know. You were a baby still.
Well, yeah, I was. Compared to them, they were all well known.
Mm-hmm.
And I became very friendly with the brother of Maurice Prendergast, who's mm-hmm. a famous, well-known painter, American, landscape figures.
Mm-hmm.
But the brother was at the research studio at that time, Charles Prendergast. And that's another story. My voice is wearing.
Yeah, no, we've got a lot of stuff. So thank you so much for talking with me.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
I know. I'm sure we'll talk again soon.
Yeah, and
thank you.
I got to show you those 2 horses now.
Oh, I'm very excited about it.